Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. Earlier this week, we spoke with returning guest Michael Jung about his new book, Crimes of Command. What Michael looked at was how the Navy's understanding of responsibility, accountability, and culpability has changed since World War II. And as a framework, he looked at 14 officers who were removed from command and the reasons behind it and some of the lessons that we can learn from it when looking at that question about responsibility, accountability, and culpability. Enjoy it, and let's go ahead and jump in with our conversation with Michael Jung about his book, Crimes of Command. And Michael, welcome back to Midrats.
It's great to be here.
Michael, first of all, thanks for coming back on. And if the listeners haven't already, you'll find over at the show page a link to what we're really going to focus on today. That is the book, Crimes of Command, and that we have our author and returning guest on. And Michael, I wanted to really just begin with the baseline, because as I like to say, words mean things. And command can mean a lot of things depending upon their background and their experience. But especially in a U.S. Navy context, in the context of your book, let's start out with the word command. What does that mean, and the listeners should keep in mind during the course of our discussion?
And because command and command authority are very important to me because I'm active duty, I want to just put one quick plug in as the disclaimer that these are my own opinions. They are not the opinions of the Department of Defense, the Department of the Navy, U.S. Naval War College, my family, the College of Leadership and Ethics, or anybody else. These are me and me alone. So we've had some issues at the college lately. I just want to make sure that was very clear. Command. So one of the – trying to explain command – even in a military context, is challenging because the Army has one idea of what command is, and they'll talk about company command and tie it quite often to having Article 15 non-judicial punishment authority. But that kind of command is exceptionally different from aviation command, command of an aircraft, which is different again from command of a ship. And while the Navy talks command of a ship, and we talk about captains of ships and masters of ships, the difference between Lieutenant Junior Grade John F. Kennedy, 26-year-old, 2 years in the Navy commanding a PT boat, and Merrill Steubing, late 40s, early 50s, with 1,000 people and guests on board the Love Boat that he's accountable, responsible for, it's pretty wide-ranging in what command is. And it's almost one of those words where you have to, when someone says they had command, you kind of have to start digging a little deeper into what that meant for authority, what that meant for responsibility, what that meant for accountability, what that meant for power, what that meant for responsibilities, for limitations. When you get into the naval context of command, then you start recognizing that it's a legal authority, it is a moral authority, it's positional power, it's going to be the senior top of the hierarchical pyramid individual for either an installation that stays and doesn't move anywhere. Actually, I'm sitting here right outside the Newport Naval Station right now. Or it's going to be an operational unit, and that can be a fleet, a ship, a group of ships, a squadron of aircraft, or a group of squadrons, a wing. And each of those, that's where command for the Navy is. It's that person at the top. top of the pyramid. And why does the Navy have somebody at the top of the pyramid like that? Because we're a naval service. And if you've ever been in any kind of boat, whether it's a canoe, a rowboat, a sailboat, a motorboat, you rapidly learn that only one person can really determine where that boat's going to go. It doesn't work if you have two people rowing in a boat and one's rowing one direction and one's going the other. Someone's got to give in to the other one. There's got to be just one person in charge. It's not quite like the Highlander, but it's close.
As a position in the position of command, we've held commanding officers in the Navy or in the navies or on ships to various levels of responsibility for the action, their actions, and also the actions of their ship and crew. How, in a nutshell, how has that changed over the years? Say since you can go back to Nelson's day, and as he was, if you want to.
You don't want to talk about Bing instead?
Yeah, I was going to go with Bing too, because I think the contrast between what he did and what Nelson did, and the results they got, what happened to them, were of interest to us even today.
So I'm going to stay with the U.S. Navy, and for a lot of reasons. One is, I mean, this is the week of Trafalgar, the celebration of Trafalgar. Nelson's unfortunate death at Trafalgar means it's really difficult to figure out what would have happened next. So it's very easy to lionize somebody who dies in battle. And I'll be honest, I know the U.S. Navy pieces and parts of this better, and they're a lot easier to contrast when you stay inside one system. So go back to the founder of the Navy, John Barry, Commodore John Barry. Had command, lost command. And I think, this is the danger here, is I start to lose track of which one did what without going back to the book. Because I focused heavily on the post-World War II Cold War era. But I do know that people like John Barry, William Bainbridge, Chester Nimitz, all in, late 1700s, early 1800s, early 1900s, either grounded, foundered, lost in combat a ship, and then went back out again and commanded again and again, and had ships named after him. So you've got that on one side. You got, Bainbridge that lost his ship in Tripoli, then spends a year and a half as a prisoner of war. Compare him to Kirk Lippold. I don't see a USS Lippold coming out anytime soon. But that was one of the things I started to look at and go, okay, why are these things different? Why was Liberty different from Cole? Why was Stark different from Vincennes? And you start having to dig into each of these cases. And the first and most important thing I figured out was, anybody who says, well, Chester Nimitz wouldn't have made it in today's Navy is completely missing out just exactly how different the Navy is 115 years later. We don't have ensigns that command ships anymore. We don't have past midshipmen. We don't govern by rocks and shoals. We have the Uniform Code of Military Justice. We have professional JAG officers. We have a significant administrative bureaucracy that runs things. We have policies and procedures for just about anything. And we didn't have that back then. And that's part of why Nimitz was able to survive. If we had ensigns that had command today, more of them would survive, because that was the other difference. A lot of really junior people had issues, but they had time to fix their careers after something went wrong. A lieutenant who has a problem in command used to have a far better chance than a captain who had a problem in command when it came to rehabilitating themselves in their career. Now, not so much.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump ahead of kind of the order of the questions that I was looking at asking, because I think this flows really into your previous point. It might give you a chance to keep the thread going. But there's one quote in your book that I thought really outlined a deep issue in our Navy, and I don't know how you fix it, but it's good to recognize it and talk about it so people can maybe see indications of it in their own journey. But I'm gonna quote you to yourself here for a second, and have you talk a bit about it, especially the three words in the first sentence. So beginning of quote, quote from our author, Michael Younga. Navy culture has lost the ability to properly separate and distinguish between culpability, accountability, and responsibility. Navy culture no longer fully understands ethics and ethical dilemmas. Navy culture now sees administration and bureaucratization as professionalism. End quote. Talk a little bit about culpability, accountability, and responsibility, and how that has changed in our modern Navy.
So, just because I'm slightly paranoid, a reminder, these are my own opinions and not those of the Department of the Navy, Naval War College, et cetera, and so forth. When, I think it's been 6 months now, the lawyers for Bryce Benson came out and said the Navy is acting badly with regards to their client and the case against him with USS Fitzgerald, and talking about how individuals accepted responsibility by pleading guilty at court-martial, or the part that really got me was by headlining the administrative actions being taken, and some judicial, but largely administrative actions, as accountability actions in the cases of Jonas McCain and Fitzgerald. What was really being talked about was the punishment. And that's when we start – today when you hear someone say, I want that person held accountable, what they're really saying is I want that person punished. And that's not what holding somebody accountable is. Holding somebody accountable is when you look at them and say, what did you do? Why did you do it? What were you thinking? And you get an answer back. That is account. You're asking someone for their account of what happened. From that, you get to determine, did that individual have some responsibility? And I'll talk about responsibility in a second, a little bit further. And then you determine if they had responsibility, do they have culpability for whatever happened, if it was a bad thing or even a good thing? And those are all different and distinct, because culpability is about blame. Accountability is about explaining. Responsive, and both of those are retro thinking, looking back on something that's happened. Responsibility is different. Responsibility, it has both a forward and a backwards process. You either today have the power, the responsibility to act, the responsibility to prevent, or you have the responsibility to address and react. When we start using accountability and responsibility and culpability, and we start mishing them up into this one word of accountability and accountability actions and holding someone accountable, then the word doesn't have any meaning anymore. And we really... you don't ever hear somebody say, I want that person punished. You hear, I want them held accountable. And part of that's because we think it's wrong to say, I want that person punished, because then I've prejudged them. But if you're already speaking synonymously of hold them accountable with punish them, then you're saying the exact same thing. You're just saying it with the wrong words. And it's one thing for Joe on the street to talk like that. But when we have everything from four-star flags down to brand-new deck seamen talking that way, then you know that we really don't understand the language in our culture. So that was part one of that line. Part two is about ethics and ethical issues and challenges. I had a boss a couple of years ago who said, ethics is easy. You just figure out what the right thing to do is and then go do it. And oh my God, he could not be any more wrong. Ethics is not about choosing between right and wrong. It's about choosing between two wrongs. Sometimes it's about choosing between two rights. And then whether or not you get caught up in the Is it, do the ends justify the means? Things turned out okay, therefore my ethical decision was correct, which I reject. Or is it that I have a set of rules that tell me this is what I have to do, therefore I am making a proper ethical decision, which I also kind of reject. And there's a reason for saying kind of in that one, and we'll talk about that later on as well. But ethical challenges are not about choosing the right thing from the wrong thing. They're about choosing which of the two bad things are going to provide the least bad. In the simplest possible way, ethical decisions have to do with do no harm or do the least amount of harm. In an ideal best case scenario, ethical decisions move into how to do good, that you want to move from the do no harm to do good. And I'll be honest with you right now, in the fleet, in the Navy, everyone's trying to hold their head above the water or try and claw their way back to the surface. And it's about not just do no harm, do the least possible harm I can while I know I have to do some harm because I simply can't do anything but. And that goes into the administrative and bureaucratization and rules-based order that we have in our Navy today. We have taken everything and turned it as much as we can into a binary checklist. And there's some benefits to that. When you're fixing an engine and you have poorly trained sailors, you want a checklist that is very clear. But when you're trying to make strategic or even tactical decisions, the checklist is going to be insufficient. You are always going to have something outside the checklist. If you didn't, then we could just do algorithms, let the great God Aegis take care of everything, and we'd be done. But the world is not that simple. It doesn't work out that way. So when you try and take a specific rule set and apply it to a situation that doesn't conform to that rule set, you are going to fail. Guaranteed. If it doesn't happen every time, it's going to happen often enough that you shouldn't be going that route. And none of that is to denigrate bureaucracy or administration, because both of those are how large organizations operate. That's how they keep moving forward. It's how people get paid, promoted, take leave. All those things have to happen. And you have to be able to do them and do them well. The problem is when we confuse them with the idea of being ethical. Getting a fitness report submitted to the Bureau of Personnel on time is not an ethical dilemma. That is basic admin that needs to get done. And if somebody's in a position where they're having to think ethically about whether they should get a fitness report turned in on time, they've really missed the boat.
In reading the book, I was struck by what I call the Kimmelization effect, named personally named after Admiral Husband Kimmel, where outside influence has wreaked havoc with some of the inside aspects of the Navy. And how much did you perceive that to be what's happened to the people? I mean, Kimmel got in trouble. I think the Navy would have probably kept him, but there was a lot of congressional pressure brought to General Short. And how much of that has trickled down to today, where a lot of the actions we see appear to be designed to head off any inquiries made from outside the service? And how is that a major factor in what's going on now?
Well, I didn't cover this case in my book. Because I didn't put him one of the things I tried to do with specific cases I did was to mirror them out across time. But the Farsi Island incident, to me, is a modern example of the Husband Kimmelization. David Nartker did what he'd been trained, acted in a way, he was executing what he believed to be mission command, and he was let down by his chain of command at multiple levels who were held, they were taken to account for it, found wanting, found responsible for not having acted in a proper way. But Surface Navy leadership took away this officer's SWO pin to show how serious they were about his actions. We have a convicted rapist whose SWO pin was not taken away after he raped one of his sailors while he was in command. So there's a point, there's a time where I start to wonder, where are we thinking about this admin side? How does that work? Are we doing the right thing administratively? Are we doing the right? Husband Kimmel and the direction the government took had to happen. He was taken out of Pearl Harbor. He was put in command of a district for a while, which was a common practice in that day. And he retired close to the end of the war. The place you begin to see the real Kimmelization start comes up with Charles McVeigh in Indianapolis. And you see it again with Kirk Leupold. You see it with Janet Vavasour and William P. Lawrence. You see not so much doing things to get ahead of a problem. There's a couple cases where that's happened. But the more common thing you see is an inability of Navy leadership to look at families and say, I'm sorry. Things sometimes happen that are bad. And that doesn't mean that any individual specifically is at fault, because they were doing what they thought was correct for the moment, that we had trained them was correct for the moment, but things turned out badly. That happened to McVeigh, that happened to Leupold, that happened to Vavasour, that happened to Nartker, that happened to his name's escaping me right now, the commanding officer of Ranger in 1983, which was one of the major turning points. That happened to it happened to Brindle and Stark. They were operating well within the norm for their training and their culture. But something bad happened, and we had to hold someone accountable, quote, so they were punished. And the upper level chain of command in that entire process, who helped create that culture, who either trained or failed to train or improperly trained their subordinates, ended up continuing and moving on.
The approach you took to your book that I thought was, in a word, refreshing, Michael, was when somebody might look at first glance, hey, somebody's written a book about all these COs who have been fired from command, a not small percentage of people, what immediately is going to flash to mind is the Navy Times effect, that it's going to be some salacious tale of people running around Suda Bay wearing nothing but their combination cover or canoodling with their YN3, but it's not. You've specifically focused on a certain type of command crisis, and you define the subjects that you picked out. You picked out 14 examples, crimes of command. Talk specifically what the crimes of command are and the type of reliefs that you focus on in your book.
So there's a couple pieces in this. And one of the things I ended up having to do was I had to start defining my own terms. And I start talking about removal from command, because we relieve officers of command all the time. I was relieved of command by my normally scheduled relief. So to say someone was relieved makes it gets murky, and we don't get fired. And there were some other, and the phrase has changed over time. So I try to use the phrase removed from command. And then that also then links into this crime of command. And I owe that concept to a lawyer named Gene Fidel, who teaches over at the Yale Law School. If you've never had him on MidRats, you should. Brilliant guy. Wrote a couple articles that were bedrocked for me to understand how I needed to put this concept together. And in the same way, we talked about command and how it can be different in different places. Well, a crime of command is a purely nautical, purely naval, and to some degree, purely ship. Aviation can have it to some degree, but a crime of command is a crime that can only happen for the individual who is in command of that unit. So a ship runs aground, The commanding officer is responsible for the operation of that ship. The commanding officer may have culpability for that ship going aground. The last I checked, it's really difficult for any shore-based unit to run aground. There are other challenges and issues they have, but those things can happen to CEOs of regular businesses. You know, financial malfeasance is the kind of thing that can happen in the civilian world and in the military world. So that's not a command issue. Major explosion, that's a command issue. Over in Virginia Beach, that huge amount of fuel that was spilled, that could have been seen as a crime of command. It ended up being looked at a little differently. Grounding, explosion, being attacked is the kind of thing that's a crime of command. If there is a law, a regulation, or sometimes a custom that ties the commanding officer's responsibility and potential culpability to an action of the ship, whether or not that commanding officer was personally and materially involved, that's a crime of command. And that's why it's different from a DUI, which anybody can get. And if you happen to be in command when you get a DUI, you're probably going to get removed from command nowadays. The same thing with the canoodling with one of your subordinates, likely to get removed from command or removed from your director position in charge of a major intelligence organization kind of thing. That's not a crime of command. And it helped to narrow it down as to a unique and military and naval discussion and keep it away from the salacious nature of things. That said, those salacious issues are part of the conversation because we now treat the individuals who have operational failings exactly the same as those who have personal failings, which means if your ship gets hit by another ship or if you hit another ship, your chances of career recovery are the same as the guy who gets the DUI. And I'm not so sure that's the right thing. That's an area where I worry and wonder, you know, the Nimitz running aground on an uncharted sandbar. Would have been a real shame if we had lost Chester Nimitz as an ensign and had to rely on some of the other personalities in World War II to carry us through in the Pacific. There's some other names. Actually, Sal, you ran a laundry list for me in June of people who had missteps in command along the way, who had multiple stars. A lot of those incidents, those officers recovered because they were really junior or the incident was never heard of. One of the ones I picked up on was USS Bennington, which I had never heard of, and I wouldn't have heard of if I hadn't lived here in Newport. Walking my dogs at Fort Adams, and there was a bench. And I went over and I looked at the bench and talked about it's a memorial to USS Bennington and the 100 sailors who died on board that ship, the aircraft carrier, in an explosion. And I'm reading it, and I thought I was fairly well read on naval history, and I had never heard of this incident. And then I dug into it, and I dug into it, and I dug into it. It became one of the cases for the book, and the guy who commanded that went on to run the Polaris program and was the guy that carried us through to the point where we had submarine-launched ballistic missiles. That is not a skill set that just falls off a tree. And in today's day and age, the families would have clamored for someone's head, even though it was very similar to Iowa. They really couldn't figure out exactly what happened because everybody who was there in the space died. And the two spaces in front of it and back of it, and the explosion was horrific, had to do with compressing hydraulic fluid in the catapults. They were on their 13th or 14th launch of the morning when the explosion happened. No real fire, just one massive explosion that killed a lot of people. And, you know, today we would want to find someone. He had command. Commanding officers have ultimate and absolute accountability, responsibility, and authority on board their ship. Except they really don't. As a friend of mine who just left command talked about, you know, he's told he has absolute authority, accountability, and responsibility, but if he's shorthanded on sailors, All he can do is send a message. He can't go out and hire new sailors. The menu system we have is such that you can't even change the daily menu. So just exactly how ultimate and absolute is your authority if you can't even change the menu for a new meal? Even the most henpecked husband can usually do that.
One of the things you, cite in your book was that famous Wall Street Journal editorial,
Hobson's choice,
after Hobson got cut in half by a carrier. And I'm reading that, I think there was a point when I thought that was the way it was. I mean, I think one of the things your book points out is that there was a difference at one time between the accountability, responsibility, and culpability. And we used to sort that out, I believe, in the old days by courts martial and maybe some investigations, almost peer review, long green table sort of things. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So one of the things I look for is where I knew things changed. All you have to do is go back and read a couple case studies from World War II and post-World War II and go, okay, things are different now. And I began to look, where did things change? How did they change? And one of the places where things really changed came in with the professionalization and creation of the Judge Advocate General Corps. And some of it, there's a lot of causation correlation question in this. It happens in the late 60s. A lot of other things change in the late 60s. We change out our ship types and many other things happen along the way. But having professional lawyers who are trained as lawyers first and then become naval officers second has had an impact on how we look at investigations. And to some degree, there's also a reticence to have the Navy's dirty laundry aired in public. And that's not a new thing. Nimitz was against the Navy's dirty laundry being aired in public. So this is a longstanding discussion. But there was a level of transparency necessary for the force to understand what happened and to get to the truth. In the cases up into the 60s and even into the 70s, investigations, Board of Inquiry, Courts of Inquiry, they were there to find out the truth. There's a line in Bradley Penniston's book about Samuel B. Roberts, and I'm hoping I got that recollection correct, name and author and book name, but it's about the Sammy B. book. And the CO of Sammy B. says in there that he, from the moment the investigator came on board, and for a reminder for those that aren't familiar with it, Samuel B. Roberts was escorting some Kuwaiti flag tankers in Operation Earnest Will, ran across a mine, blew her back out, almost sank. Short version. CO's credited with holding that ship together, still speaks on it today. Fascinating man, great stories. But he said he believes the investigator came on board not to find out what happened, but to affix blame. And that was in 88, 89. When you reach a point there, when the investigator's first thing is not to find out what happened, but to affix blame, you've already lost what the real focus of the investigation should be. So the lawyers, fixing blame, and keeping things out of the public eye, those are all parts of that. Because I did this book on my own time, or as much as you can be on your own time as an active duty officer, that's a whole nother interesting discussion and piece in part. All of the case studies I got were either previously released or I requested via the Freedom of Information Act. And I learned a lot about how we, as a culture, a naval culture, keep information from getting out into the public. And it's not a good thing. I fully suspect we will never, ever see the full investigations on Fitzgerald and John S. McCain, because those investigations were done as what's called a dual purpose investigation. And while it says dual purpose, its really primary purpose is to be supervised by a lawyer so that it is being completed in anticipation of litigation. And because it's being completed in anticipation of litigation, it is exempt wholly and fully from disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. Doing a dual purpose investigation for any of these collisions or any of the other case studies I had, and any of probably 200 others that I could think of based on what I have on my database, is completely in contravention with our own guidance. The manual for the Judge Advocate General clearly talks about when you do dual purpose investigations and when you do courts and boards of inquiry. And for every one of these things that's happened, if it made the press, if somebody died, if a ship went aground and there was significant damage and it was taken offline, so we're talking everything from Stark to Port Royal to Samuel B. Roberts to William P. Lawrence, John S. McCain, Fitzgerald, I think it was Antietam, Lake Champlain, every one of those should have had a court or a board of inquiry. The only difference between a court of inquiry and a board of inquiry, the court of inquiry, if I remember this right, can subpoena civilians. The board cannot. And if you go back to, you start talking about Hobson, within, I think it was a week of that collision, there was a board of inquiry that was held. And that is where the accountability process began, with a convened board, an open hearing, an open court, an open testimony of what happened. If there were things where classified information came, not embarrassing, but classified, not overly classified because you don't want to be embarrassed, no kidding, real classified information, they could go to closed session. But otherwise, it was open session, people sitting in the courtroom. And that's how these things were handled. Then the three officers who were charged with being part of the board of the court would write up their opinions, their findings, their recommendations. And if one of them disagreed, as happened in the Hobson collision, the senior member disagreed with the other two members and wrote a minority opinion. Fascinating to dig through it all. It's really bad copies and it's been redacted. So you have to really dig through it. And fortunately, we have a really great archive here at the War College. And I was able to find his papers here and read through, found his travel claim on it. I found the minority opinion. We don't get that anymore. What we get now is this dual purpose investigation, which has been distilled down to one person's opinion with that may or may not actually have followed the requirements and the guidelines wherein every opinion has to be supported by at least one, if not more than one, finding of fact. And we don't get that. We get how do we find a point in a fixed blame. So when Vermont Royster wrote that Hobson Choice article, he writes in there about the accountability of well-intentioned men. And there is it's a beautifully written piece. And indirect, there was a time when I thought this explains it. This is everything. But if you start to listen and if you recognize when people mix accountability and punish, and they're using accountability wrong, when someone says that is accountability, do they mean accountability or do they mean punish? When Royster writes and says this accountability of well-intentioned men, is he talking about punishing well-intentioned men? I don't think so, because he is writing this before – he's writing this after we know the commanding officer of the ship is dead and before the board of inquiry, and we know there's going to be a board of inquiry. No one at any point is saying that there's not going to be an accounting for what happened. What everyone did say was, I don't think we're going to immediately punish anybody until we know what's going on. And even after the board, the senior member disagreed with the other two members of the board as to exactly what the command, what happened, because the senior member disagreed with the other two members who said, we think this is what the commanding officer did and this is what was going on in his head. And the senior member said, we don't know that. We can't know that. We don't get that kind of discussion anymore. We don't get that kind of argument anymore. We don't get that kind of, and if you can't get an argument about something, you can't get to the truth of it. If we all agree and all believe the same thing, then we only need to have one of us. sorry, launched into something of a rant there about this, but this, I know, again, my opinion, not that maybe we don't do courts and boards of inquiry because Navy lawyers have decided that they are too hard and they are too expensive and they're not worth the time and they are wrong. And they're wrong, and you can see it with the fact that we're going to be a year and a half to 2 years after Fitzgerald's collision, and we're not going to be done with the legal issues there, and we're still not going to have the report released. Every one of those other cases I had within 3 to 6 months was done beginning to end. We are dragging this thing out in a way, and we're hurting the families by dragging it out the way we are, of both the victims and the survivors.
You know, Michael, no reason to apologize. Your rant is both justified and welcome. As a matter of fact, while you're talking, I was thinking I was about to take you down a rabbit hole that, as long as you're on active duty, I don't think I'll do with the record button go. But next time we find ourselves once again in the same town, with or without your lovely wife, we need to share a beer and talk about it. Because you're exactly spot on with that, and the passion of John Brown is needed on this subject. But let me go to something you've already put on the record. I can't get you in trouble on.
you'd be surprised.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Well, you've never been one to shy with their opinion, whether others want to hear it or not, and that's good and healthy. We support that. But you brought up another interesting concept, and again, I recommend this to the listener. If you want to see some discussions about, they're fuzzy concepts, but gosh, they're important, not just in our Navy, but in professional life on the civilian sector too. But there's a thing about a culture and a friction that you find in our Navy culture that I believe has probably informed some of the changes that you outline during the course of living memory, not ancient history, living memory in our Navy. But talk a bit about the friction, about the conceptual differences between the art of command and the science of technology in our Navy.
So this is one, so the biggest surprise for me in writing, when I started writing on this, I fully expected that tailhook was going to be the central change as to how things changed in our Navy. And I was wrong. When I laid everything out and I took all the numbers I have a database of 1,500 incidents now. When I laid them all out and I took a look at who we knew had been removed or likely been removed from command, the uptick was already prevalent a decade before tailhook. So then I thought of the other famous case, which is Arnheiter and the Arnheiter affair. And if anybody's out there and hasn't read the Arnheiter affair, and if you're going to command of a U.S. Navy ship, you need to go find that book. It's out of print. There's a beautiful sordid story behind it. I've been trying to get in touch with Neil Sheehan to convince him to let me write a new updated version. So that way I can just take most of his and add to it.
I have a first edition of that book. It's on the prime shelf in my library, but I'll second that.
It's in that it's, 50 years old and still applicable to leadership at sea today is also amazing. So, but then I looked at the numbers, and while 68, 69, 70 was a really bad time in the Navy, also not a place where things changed. And then I start taking a look and I get to 83 and I'm like, wait. And then I start to read something and I read something I've seen before. And then I go digging for this quote and I find out that it's, Hyman G. Rickover. And that Hyman G. Rickover and the technocracy of the Navy, and this is something I still wrestle with today, even after having written thousands of words on it. The short form answer of science and art of command is science is typically distilled down to a binary, to a one or a zero, to a yes or a no. And an art is never distilled that way. Now, there are some things, ship handling, even we've shown for decades, landing an airplane on an aircraft carrier can be done in an automated fashion. Ships can maintain their position in an automated fashion. You can get that down to ones and zeros if you have the right technology. You can't lead people that way. We don't have that knowledge yet. I'm not sure if we ever will. A lot of it depends on the coming singularity and all the rest of that stuff. And I have great skepticism about it because in a lot of ways, what we think is going to happen and what really happens typically doesn't work out that way. But anytime that you're leading people, there is no guarantee of what's going to happen. You might have a pretty good statistically significant idea. But the very fact that 2 years ago this month, my wife and I alternated being awake all night because we weren't sure what was going to come out of the Tuesday evening into Wednesday morning election shows that statistically probable does not mean guaranteed. So the art of command has to do with the people. And the Navy sometimes forgets that commanding a ship is about commanding the crew and managing the equipment. We think of it as commanding the ship, and that you're commanding the equipment and administrating the crew. And I mean, and that's a very, it's a direct statement, and not necessarily, it's not always true, but if there's a bad situation someplace, that is probably at the difference. You can't command equipment. Rickover knew that. So Rickover put together a system by which you could control people as best you could in the realm of the possible. And when you're dealing with nuclear power, I fully understand that idea. The problem is he trained everyone in nuclear power that way. And that means the culture of nuclear power is about following the checklist, the yes or the no. Was this done? Was this not done? And art and science, when I've used an analogy for art and science in the past, I've talked about the difference between paint by numbers and the masters. Now, if you take a master, a classically trained artist, and you give them a paint by number piece, they're going to do fascinating things with it. But if you take someone who's only ever done paint by numbers and say, paint me a portrait, you're not going to get quite the same result. And that's, again, not to denigrate some people. There are some people out there where the best painting they are ever, ever going to do is a paint by number. And they should be proud of it and happy of it. Everyone has a different role in life. Not everyone is intended to command at sea. But when you get to command, you have to give up the paint by number piece. You have to move into leading people, and leading people is about understanding how to paint that portrait, not how to follow within the lines.
Well, that's an excellent point. One of the consequences, what I call the, what other people have called the Rickover effect, is a lot of people are afraid to make mistakes. And I thought it was interesting that the time when we were trying, many years ago, trying to bring Deming into the fleet, one of his philosophies, points was, drive out fear. We had these inconsistent, in my mind, goals, which caused some schizophrenic behavior. But talk a little bit about the fear of making mistakes and what that's done to us.
So and this is also not a new thing. When Zumwalt took over as chief of naval operations, he had to put a message out saying, captains, get your ships underway, do practice landings, and if you ding your ship up, you are not going to get in trouble. So that goes back to the 70s. There was an article I found by a lieutenant who was going into his first nuclear power tour who talked about the culture Rickover created and how one of the goals in life for a nuclear power officer at the time, this is what he said, and I've had some nukes challenge me on this. I'd like to have somebody from outside the culture go take a look, because I'm always – people inside the culture can never really properly diagnose the culture. Somebody from the outside needs to come in and take a good look at it. But the idea was that if you didn't make any mistakes, if you did what you were told and nothing more, you would make it to command. And what that does then, it breeds fear of making a mistake. And part of the problem is because we don't differentiate between mistakes and sins. We don't differentiate between not knowing what's right and intentionally doing the wrong thing. In this day and age, anyone who drinks and drives and they're in command, they know they're doing the wrong thing. Running your ship aground because you're trying to execute a mission might not be a wrong thing. That needs to get dug into, and we sometimes get very binary about, nope, it's wrong. Running a ship aground is wrong, period, done. And that's been a mantra within the Navy for a long time, too, and there's enough cases to show that that's not really the case. But, you know, the one place I was asked about technology and whether technology had an impact on commanding officer removals, and I don't think it does, but the place I do think technology plays in is with this fear factor. And what you have, go back in time, before telephones, and a commanding officer went home at night, comes back in the next morning, get a brief from the command duty officer. Captain, this is what happened last night. This is what we did. This is what we handled. This is the message we sent out. These are the folks that went to the hospital. Captain comes in and says, okay, great. Or, all right, well, I wish you'd done this or done that. And they move on. Phones come in with landlines before you had voice answering machines. Get a phone call. And that culture was still there. Captain, we've sent an Op Rep 3 Navy blew out because we had a fire in, you know, Charlie Switchboard. Now we've got to the point where it's instantaneous, constant ability to communicate with the commanding officer, and you have command duty officers who, as soon as the fire happens, their first call is the commanding officer, and it can be, Captain, we have a fire in Class Charlie Switchboard. Personnel are on scene. Fire is out. What do you want me to do? And that is not a good way to train commanders. Because what happens then is you have that same junior officer become a department head, becomes command duty officer. Captain, we have a flooding in the aft machinery room. It's been secured. What do you want me to do? And then they come into command. And in command, you cannot call your boss and find out what the boss wants you to do for everything. You're supposed to be commanding. And that's an area where I'm concerned about technology, because commanders will only lose command and lose command authority when they cede it. No commanding officer in there is going to lose command to an admiral at the other end of a radio circuit, at the other end of a chat line, at the other end of a cell phone. You're still on scene and you command. Until you do that moment when you say, boss, what do you want me to do? And then you have ceded command. And that's the part that I'm most concerned about. Because if we ever get into a comms denied environment, if we ever have to test Arleigh Burke's supposition about the difference between a good officer and a great officer, if we're ever in those positions, there's not time to call the boss and say, boss, what do you want me to do? That's when the commanding officer has to make a decision. And they need to have spent their entire career, not their entire lives, up to that point thinking, what am I going to do if X happens? And if they haven't ever thought about X, maybe it's close to Y or Z, and they've thought about that, and they've got a general idea of what to do. But if they're always calling back and asking, Mother, may I, they're never going to have the autonomy they need to really command.
As in many things in life, especially in the Navy, when it comes to being a good leader, a good officer, and a good CO. It's you learn in both positive ways, as in things that are good and that you want to emulate, and also bad things that we say, I'm not going to do that when I get there. And you learn by both direct experience, but also by reading. Reading what other leaders have experienced and their thoughts on their experience. And you make a good point in the book that I haven't really realized before. I have, again, over in my library, I have a shelf of biographies of Navy admirals. And you made the point that Navy admirals are no longer writing biographies. First of all, do you have some thoughts on Matter of fact, I think the most recent admiral's biography I have, actually an autobiography, was Sandy Woodward, who was the admiral in charge of the Falklands. From the 1980s.
If you have that, when we get done with this, you need to go flip to the afterword that he wrote and just read that real quick. I make my students always read that when we do the Falklands.
I'll do that because I haven't read that in golly probably 20 years.
I don't know why they've stopped writing. I don't think it's a technocracy thing. I don't know if it's what happened to Mahan and his fitness reports where he was told naval it's not the business of naval officers to write books. I don't know. I would be happy if they just did oral histories. If they sat down at the Naval Institute, really reinvigorated its naval history program, and I need to work here, the War College used to have a really good oral history program. And I tell you, there are some things I got out of oral histories that were fascinatingly and superb. And I mean, there are some people whose oral histories I read cover to cover that never made it in the book because they were so good that they didn't have to tie the threads together. They could have been a book in and of themselves. And that's pretty rare for an oral history. But when, you know, Vern Clark finished up as being chief of naval operations and disappeared, we know nothing anymore about where he is or what he's doing. You'll get some thinking books. You know, McChrystal did a leadership book. Zinni did a leadership book, did a war book. But they're not writing – we're not getting sage advice about life and how they lived and how their lives impacted their service. And it would be nice to see that.
Well, speaking of books, we've been pitching yours pretty hard here tonight. It's an excellent read.
Thank you.
And what else have you, as I think we've probably taken up a lot of your time, but what else are you working on that we need to look for in the future, and when can we see it?
So, let's see. I just changed jobs here at the War College. I've gone from teaching joint military operations to working in the College of Leadership and Ethics. I finished my dissertation, so I'm somewhat adrift. I'm in a new place, doing a new thing, with everything wide open in front of me. Now, the good news is that that's allowed me to propose and present a paper. I'm on a panel here for the Salve Regina, beginning of November, on Humanities and Technology Association. I'm going down to Dahlonega, Georgia, to be on a panel about contractors and private military contractors, and my approach is looking at what happens to them after they're captured. But usually it's about, you know, how do you deal with the gun-toting folks from Z? There's a lot more to deal with contractors in future war, and I'm going back to World War II in a case of Wake Island to talk about that. My biggest research lately has been having to do with the profession and ethics and character. I'm trying to get my hands, my brain around the supporting documentation to the CNO's Navy Leader Development Framework and to be able to articulate what the distinctions are between character and competence. The CNO wrote, and people will be shocked to hear this from me, he wrote a really good framework for leadership development. The one criticism I have is the two cornerstone pieces to it. One cornerstone is character, and the other is competence. Neither of those are really well defined. And we go back to my commentary about a former boss that talked about ethics being really simple. You just find pick the right thing to do, and you do it. Everyone knows what character is. Well, do we? Everyone knows what competence is. Do we? That's what I want to – that's what I'm digging into and trying to figure it out. That one – probably not until next year sometime.
Well, Michael, it's been great having you on as well. Great opportunity to talk to you. I look forward to having you on again in the future, and I hope you have a great fall.
You too. Thank you. And a reminder, not all my own opinions, not the Department of Defense. When you sit down to have a conversation with your boss and it starts off with, if at any point in time you begin to feel uncomfortable, just let me know and I can read you your rights and we can go to Admiral's Mast, you tend to be very careful about these things.
It focuses the mind, I think.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Until next time on MidRats, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.